You are listening to a Student Radio Association podcast.
Hello and welcome to the SRA show on In Radio. You're listening to Jodie Bryant. I'm part of the podcast team for the SRA, and today's show is all about the Charles Parker Prize. So the awards have just taken place. They took place last month in Bristol, and they celebrate great student radio documentaries. For those of you who don't know, Charles Parker was a BBC radio producer and specialised in documentary radio about real people in small towns and villages with real stories. His documentaries are some of the best ever made to this day. With a nationally celebrated day and a festival in honour of his name, he has left a great legacy behind. So for the next 25 minutes, we join Spark FM and the University of Sunderland students who entered the Charles Parker Prize. So we're going to hear from a few of their documentaries. Up first is Jake Cusworth, who has made a piece all about the attraction of a cup of tea.
Oh, it depends, you know, that's a hard question. We're probably going to have to talk about the milk debate, aren't we? As I'm a milk in the cup first kind of boy. But I'm not going to judge you if you're milk after, don't worry. My name's Sam Quilliam and I'm owner of Quilliam Brothers Tea House.
Oh, big question. Very big question. I would say, personal preference, we have a really nice Chinese black tea from the Kemen province. It's a Maofeng pick, which is pretty special. Yeah, it's got like this sort of really sort of rich, smoky flavour. It's quite powerful and punchy, but at the same time, it has very little tannin, so you don't have that sort of cloying feeling in your mouth. It's a treat. It's an absolute delight, that one is. My name is Daniel Holmes. I'm the manager here at School of Arts.
We love Newcastle. We wanted to bring something which added something a bit different to the city. My older brother, Tom, he was in Budapest running his hostel. It's a traveller's hostel, which he had for a few years. Over there is a massive tea house culture. Places which don't do alcohol, serve many a tea, food and stuff like that. Open late night. We really, really dig the idea. We love that idea.
Yes, rooibos. So as in my boss called Roy. It's just literally the translation from Redbush. Most popular tea. That'll be one of our flavoured ones. Because that's quite a good way to get into teas, like the flavoured teas. We've got one which is flavour of caramel. Interestingly, a flavoured oolong, which is very popular. We have an apple crumble and cream, we call it. It's got apple bits, pomegranates, flowers. You've got a really interesting thing in that called snow tea, sometimes called snow white. It's this herb. It sort of grows in this long white strand, and when you dry it and brew it up in water, it gives things a vaguely creamy flavour. Without giving it a creamy texture, it's interesting stuff. So those two are definitely our most popular ones. Apart from that, though, as well, breakfast blend. Everyone comes in just can I have it? Just a tea. Just a tea there, mate. Breakfast blend's usually the one you go for. And over here, sir.
I'm going to have the breakfast blend. If that's
breakfast blend?
Yeah.
My strong breakfast brew. Originally, I came here to do coffee training with the first round of staff. But then, slowly but surely, I was just I love this place so much. I got just poached over. It was so nice. I could not work here. The customers are really nice. It's just good. I just really enjoy it. I mean, I wouldn't be here for 2 years if I didn't enjoy it. You know what I mean? I knew loads about coffee before I started on here, but since being here, I love tea now. The world of tea is fascinating. Seriously, customers have to stop me or else I will talk for hours and hours about tea. All about what Maofengs and Picots and superior flowery tippy goldens and all that jazz. Are you about ready to go?
I think so.
Fantastic. What can I get you then?
So we do a different kind of service, and as far as we're aware, we haven't really seen a service anywhere else other than Budapest. We kind of took some ideas from there. We actually brew the teas for the customers because we're aware that some loose leaf tea, quite a lot of loose leaf tea, if just put in the pot and left to brew, it can easily overbrew and taste not very nice at all. Especially when, as a customer, you're just coming in for a nice chilled time. You don't want to be the reason for your tea going awful. So we brew it depending how long or what tea it is. Black tea is 3 minutes mostly, for 3 minutes, and we actually sieve it into the pot so there's no lees left in. So the pot's ready to go, ready to drink for the customers. It eradicates any terrible brewing and awful taste, because the idea of this is to give people nice tea. Because we've got 70 different teas, we need to be as quick as possible on the floor taking orders. So if someone orders a breakfast blend, instead of writing on the check pad, breakfast blend, we write B1. So it's just, it's a kind of a thing to make our life easier, and also customers get to know their regular tea, so they say can have an F11, which is caramel cup. I don't know, it's quite a nice feeling. Also, it looks really mint having codes on tins, I think.
But, well, they do change the tea codes every now and then. Like, sometimes a new tea would put in, so it shifts every tea one up. That confuses you a bit. When you spend hours and hours just in that little corner, sort of reaching for, like, B2, F11, B6, you know, R2, you know, it's all just going to stick eventually. It's my little party trick, actually. Customers quite often like it. Say it's like an evening time, you're having a bit of banter. You go like, oh, go on, test me. I'll say the code and I'll tell you the name. I've never yet been wrong, and it's always been quite impressive. So, Alistair, I think I might need ordering.
Even now, by no means are we experts, we're just fanatics.
So I've got a green sort of frog. All right, sorry, is there a particular tea?
There is a tea that is going to be just working wonders for you. Okay. All right, it's a herbal tea.
Yeah.
Its main base is lemongrass, but it's got like lots of like licorice and ginger and like peppercorn. It's like really like pow, makes it. It's like lem sip on steroids. It's amazing.
Fantastic.
That's called the Pep Up. That is, it's the herbal blend that'll be coming down for you.
Brilliant.
Well, you're asked the right guys.
You know, the great thing about teas, it's a social event, it's a social occasion. Like, put the kettle on, come on, have a little chat about how we're doing. And we were always a family of get the kettle on. We always had a pot on the go. And I think that's where our love for tea comes from. From then, we've learned a bit more about tea. But, like, even the people that we've gone to meet in India who run these tea estates, they say we're not experts. They say we just scratch the surface of tea because there's so much to learn. We just love to show other people what tea there is out there and show our kind of our love for it. That's the attraction of tea for us.
And that was The Attraction of Tea for Us by Jake Cusworth. Another entry into the Charles Parker Prize was Root Karaya's minimalistic tale of three families with adopted children. This one's called Love Beyond the Womb.
I have lots of really early memories. I don't know which one is the earliest. People doing drugs, waking up in random houses without electricity.
I didn't let it define me. It's not all of who I am, it's just part of who I am.
I think it was very confusing because I'd get information in dribs and drabs. I mean, my parents weren't secretive. If we had a question, they'd answer it.
I always knew I was adopted. I moved in with my parents when I was 4. At that time, they were just my guardians. Basically, one day, my birth mom, she dropped me off at my grandmother's place, and she said, oh, can you look after Khud for a couple of hours? I need to go somewhere. And 2 weeks later, she hadn't come back. And at some point, my uncle and my aunt decided to become my guardians, so I moved in with them. My dad is my birth father's brother. Even though I lived with him since I was 4, officially I was only their daughter by the age of 12 or 13.
There was a lot of, like, iffiness, if that's even a word, when I first found out I was adopted. But it was never, ever about they weren't my parents. Throughout this, it was always, you are my parents, you are my mum and dad. They were the ones that loved us, brought us up closer, so yeah.
It's become quite a part of us. Like, I don't think it's quite a big deal, but it's definitely affected us in good ways and bad ways.
I was adopted because both my parents were addicted to heroin, and it was very clear that they couldn't take care of me. When I was a kid, I always, for instance, tried to hide it in a way. I kept it quiet. I was quite reserved about it. Who needed to know, like my teachers and things like that? My parents would talk to them, but they were always like, please don't mention it. Like, it's not a secret, but it's something that she prefers to be reserved about.
I've found it's better to share. I had a bit of a struggle because I told my best friend in primary school, and she told everybody else. And then I got told off for telling that, because they were like, it's not just your information to share. And I was like, well, actually, it is my information to share if I feel comfortable.
I think there's two people, friends and enemies. And I think the friends were amazing about it. Like, why are you making a big deal of it, even telling us? And then I think the enemies, if you like, they were the bullies. I think the biggest thing with children is they'll pick on the slightest thing that makes you different. And with me, it was my adoption. If they want to make a big deal out of it, then, you know, I used to just say, at least my parents chose me, you always had to have you. For me, it was about shutting them up.
I was very aware that my family was different, or at least that my role in the family was different. For me, they were always there. I wasn't always there for them. And when I arrived, I was like, I was a kid, I was 4 years old, but I wasn't a baby, which is a bit different than what most kids will be when they arrive to their families.
I feel that if you point out that it's not a bad thing when you're young, like, even if people aren't adopted, like, to say to kids, look, it's normal, it's not any different than, like, people who have been born and kept in the same family.
And like most child things, you never grow out of being adopted, and it's something that sticks with you your whole life. Eventually, in terms of daily life, it becomes an issue for legal reasons. When I changed my name, I had to change all my documents.
Most recently, I got knocked back for life insurance because I didn't know my family's history. It's a big deal, or it can be a big deal. It's up to organisations to make a big deal out of it. For me, it's not a big deal. I don't know my family history. Obviously, it would be nice to have life insurance, but if I can't have it, then so be it. But yeah, it's like, it's a lot of form filling, because obviously wherever you go, there's forms, and it's always past, like, family illnesses or whatever.
With GPs, I'm totally honest up front. If they ask us about my medical history, I'm like, to be honest, I don't know. I'm adopted. I have no idea.
I don't know if the amount of questions has grown, but yeah, the questions have never left. I don't think they have increased in number. They may have shifted a little bit. My view on them has also shifted, or maybe the reason why I asked them may have changed. But they're still there.
Having had the unique insight into living with Pamela, my birth mum, I'm in a very blessed position, if you like, as to know that my life would have been different had I not been adopted. No one wants to be adopted, but, you know, my life has turned out for the better.
I think it's basically what made me. Like, I mean, I have extremely rough times, but when it comes to socialising, I'm very talkative, very friendly. Often I'll just, like, meet a person, I'll just be like, hi, I'm Holly, I'm adopted.
So that was a bit of Love Beyond the Womb from University of Sunderland's Ruth Kariah. If you've just started listening, this is the SRA show on In Radio, and we are listening to some great student radio documentaries, all from Spark FM at the University of Sunderland. These documentaries all celebrate and were entries into the Charles Parker Prize. Up next is RJ Phoenix with her documentary entitled The Easter Bell.
It's a silence you can hear because you're surrounded by enormous mountains, the sea, the samaras in the distance. You get the lapping of the water, you get the seabirds, there's wildlife, but there's that stillness which is tangible.
We started that show in St. Columbus, but then we decided this was one of the shows we were going to tour.
But we'd had such a great time going up to Iona as a group, going over to Donegal as a group, that we thought, we've got to do this again.
I was a youth leader, and I used to take up to the northwest highlands of Scotland some kids who loved it. I mean, I would tease them endlessly. We would get to the border and I'd say, now, come on, you've got to put your watches back an hour. You know, we're going to a new country. You can smell the diesel from the fishermen's boats. People coming in have been grafting with the sheep.
Graham came back 1 year and he'd found 6 lodges all on the one site. And he says, look, we can fill these. We can all go up. And his enthusiasm came around. And we did, actually. And the first time we went up there, I think we must have had 50-odd people. There were people sleeping everywhere.
And we just all had a great time. And we've done it ever since. Every year we go back. It's about the only place, I think, that I've heard cuckoos. And that is, as you're walking through springtime, walking through the woods, you can hear the cuckoos.
The nearest shop, which sold milk and bread, was about a 40-mile round trip. Because we go at Easter, we decided to go to the small church, which is in the village. It's a converted cow barn, this Episcopalian church.
And that's what it looks like. And you go through the centre aisle, and there are 3 seats on either side of the aisle, which will show you how small it is and how narrow it is. It's just a lovely, cosy, warm feeling there.
It's a major celebration on Easter morning to literally make as much noise as you can. And if you have any musical instruments at all, no matter how basic, you know, blocks or tambourines or cymbals, or it's just great to make a noise, as kids do at a birthday party. They love making a noise. It's their birthday. Let's make a noise together. It was Easter morning and we all turned up to do our worship on Easter morning. And at the very end of the service, the bishop said, it is Easter morning. Let's ring all the bells to celebrate. The church warden, I heard, whisper to the bishop, I'm sorry, bishop, we can't ring the bells because our bell is broken. This community means so much to this group of people from Sunderland and has given so much. The time has come to pay back. I'm now going to make a promise that next Easter, when we come up, the bell will ring.
I think they probably thought he was just saying it. I knew different. I know what Graham's like once he gets an idea into his head.
So driving back home when the holiday was over, I'm thinking, why did I say that? Where am I going to get the bell from? Can you get them on eBay? You know. So the search started and I really had a bit of a problem. There's an organisation called Redundant Churches. But there were no bells in stock. I literally looked on eBay, but there are few and far between. I contacted churches that had closed, that may have their bells still intact, and had no joy there. By then I'd exhausted every possibility and was almost on the point of giving up, because we simply couldn't afford them. It was going to cost thousands of pounds. And it was just a chance conversation. He works in a converted church, which is now a community centre. He said, you know, Graham, I'm sure there's a bell in one of the cupboards. So I would go and have a look. And sure enough, the back of this cupboard, there was this wonderful bell, exactly the right size for the job.
And that was a great clip from RJ Phoenix of Spark FM at the University of Sunderland. So we're nearly at the end of today's show, and we're going to finish with Lisa Tewoig and her documentary Somewhere on a Blue Horizon, which is the amazing story of her parents who travelled the world for 10 years. See what you think.
The story goes that it was mistaken identity. He grabbed my arm and asked me out to dance.
I said to myself, this is sink or swim, and I let her out onto the floor. And ordinarily, I wouldn't do that. Anne says I grabbed her by the hand, but I took her by the hand.
He was a marine engineer. We got married and we went to sea.
She has a more adventurous streak even than I have. So the prospect of coming to sea, she just grabs her with both hands.
The excitement of going to a place that you know something about is very different to the excitement / terror of what am I letting myself in for?
There's a stretch of water called the Malacca Straits, which is down the side of Malaysia on the approaches to Singapore, and there's a place there called the One Fathom Bank. And ships have to slow down there because of the restricted waters. There were islands around the place, and it was a favourite place for getting jumped at night by pirates.
So there was some kind of a red alert that pirates had been particularly busy.
When we were going through dangerous waters, we would have all the deck lights lit up, illuminated. The whole ship would be lit up. There would be three or maybe four teams of two, and we would be just going around the deck. I remember I used to have a 30-inch length of steel pipe, and that was my baton. I don't know if Van was expecting Cary Grant or somebody to come leaping over the handrails or swinging in on a rope or something like Tarzan.
No, I'm not thinking it's Errol Flynn with Swashbuckle or Johnny Depp. I realise this is quite serious, and if they board the ship, then that's it.
Other ships had been attacked, and these guys were coming on with guns. They weren't coming onto the ship for a sandwich and to steal a joint of beef. They were coming on to get what they could, and they were armed. So, yeah, we were nervous. There's no doubt about that. Of course, being young, roughy tofties, we'd have an air of bravado about us, you know, and we wouldn't let on we were nervous, but we were really. And you can imagine why. We were instructed that if a grappling hook came up, you try and lift it off. If you couldn't lift it off, you use a fire hose to blast water down on whoever was trying to come up to try and prevent them coming up. If a pair of hands did appear above the handrails and somebody made it that far, the objective was to whack him on the hands and make him lose his grip and basically fall off. Desperate times and desperate measures. She had a sense of adventure about it. Was she disappointed that nothing happened? She was, if she thinks about the possibility of swashbuckling defence of the ship. But the reality of it was, because of what they had and the arms they carried, I think secretly she was glad nothing ever did.
He didn't see anything though. Note the disappointment. Not that I suppose I did want to see some guy going, "Wah!" To be quite honest, it doesn't matter where you go in the world. I've been there, done that, ate the pie, wore the t-shirt. And when I think about where I've been, it's the people that I remember or a particular culture. We were in a place in Busan, this tiny little village in South Korea now. This is in the middle of nowhere, and there were high cliffs, and the people lived in caves in the cliffs. The agent wasn't there to meet us, so we had to wait. And we stood on the pier waiting for the agent to come with our papers to say they've been discharged from the ship, good to go, and they're just going straight to the airport. And the customs arrived at gunpoint. And when they have a job to do, they have a job to do. There is no interaction. There's no smile. And they had guns. So we were just standing in the heat as well. And I decided I'd go for maybe a pack of cards or something that we could just look at. And I went for my suitcase. And they kind of went to attention. And I put my hands up. And I just said, no, it's okay.
Okay, it's only a deck of cards, but they were looking at the bag. I suppose trying to make up their minds, is it worth to look into these bags or not?
My father was big into photography, and he had acquired a spy camera for reasons only known to himself. So he asked me on my travels, if you could, would you get some rolls of film? Which I did in Japan. That's another story.
So then we had a fully functioning, concealable miniature camera with film in it. Of course, we didn't know what their reaction would be. So we were suddenly we were very nervous.
I thought, oh my God, they're going to find the spy camera. That's it. Time up, Anne. That'll be your little... She was a lovely person. Didn't she die in a Korean jail? Lovely person. She bought the spy camera and my father would beat his breast for the remaining years. But anyway, they didn't. And Barry was quite shell-shocked at the whole thing because he knew what was in my bag.
And it's a sight I'll never forget. And I stood there just looking at her. I didn't disturb her. Just looking at her, just drinking in the whole sight of the woman I love lying in my bed waiting for me. And she's carrying our child. And it was wonderful. And I'll never forget that memory. I didn't have a camera, so I don't have a physical photograph. But I have a very real photograph in my head. That moment impacted deeply on me.
I suppose I was travelling from 78 until 90 until I had my first baby. And that was an extraordinary experience.
Oh, we've always encouraged our three children to travel, to spread their wings and go and see the world. It takes the whole mystery out of other people in other countries and other creeds and races. And I'm all for it.
I'm hoping now that in the next few years I'll be able to do it again.
That was an excerpt of Somewhere on a Blue Horizon from Lisa Twerg. You've been listening to the SRA show on In Radio, and today we've been playing some of Spark FM's entries for the Charles Parker Prize. If you haven't Googled Charles Parker before, then I would definitely recommend it because he's made some incredible stuff that you should definitely give a listen to. If you have any student work like dramas or documentaries that you would love the SRA to showcase, email us at content@studentradio.org.uk. I'm Jodie Bryant and you've been listening to the SRA show on In Radio. Thank you for listening.